On Sunday Extra, this is Julian Morrow with you. Our guest on The Year That Made Me today took 259 test wickets for Australia between 1996 and 2006, and to this day holds the world record for the highest test score by a night watchman. Jason Dizzy Gillespie famously scored 201 not out in what turned out to be his last match for Australia. Jason's Crick Info profile says he stood out in the national teams of his era with his bouncing mullet, hook nose, Spofforth-like glare and love of heavy metal music. Jason's gone on to have an illustrious career coaching many teams, including Sussex, Yorkshire, South Australia, Zimbabwe and Pakistan, and most recently the Hyderabad Kingsmen in the Pakistan Super League. He's also been on a stamp, the Australia Post Legends of Cricket stamp series, and there's a bronze statue of him at the Adelaide Oval, and I'm very pleased to say that Dizzy Gillespie is our guest on The Year That Made Me. Welcome, Jason.
Oh, thanks for having me, Julian. Cheers.
It's a great pleasure. I wonder if we could start by hearing a little bit about your parents and the family that you grew up in.
Yeah, I was born in Sydney. Yeah, my parents, Vicky and Neil, and I've got two younger brothers, Rob and Luke. Yeah, lived in Sydney. Dad was working for State Bank New South Wales, and in late 85, when I was 10 years old, he got a job transfer to Adelaide with State Bank South Australia. So we moved and I started year six in South Australia, in southern suburbs, down at Flagstaff Hill. And mum and dad were like great supporters of all us boys. I was very sporty, probably a bit more sporty than my brothers, particularly cricket. I played soccer, basketball. I loved all sport, but cricket was always the love. And I remember every Christmas I would get something new from Santa to do with cricket. And I remember pretty much every Christmas morning, I'd be hounding dad to take me up to the local cricket nets and trying my new kit. And yeah, and I just have memories of mum and dad driving me around all my sport, basically all my trainings, all games. They were just a wonderful support.
Now, a lot of kids have dreamed of playing cricket for Australia, but clearly at some point it became more than just a dream for you. It was something you were really focused on. What sort of age do you think that was, Jason?
Well, I wanted to play for Australia the moment I watched Dennis Lilly bowl on the TV when I was about 6 or 7 years of age. So, you know, the fire burned brightly for me from a very young age. And, you know, I wondered whether it was going to happen in my teenage years when I had big growth spurts and had a season out through back and knee pain and things like that. I was one of the shortest kids in my class in year 9 and came back in year 10 and I was one of the tallest kids in the grade. So grew half a foot over the course of a summer. But the fire burnt bright. I always dreamed of wanting to play for Australia. That never wavered. I was about 16, 17, and I remember at club practice one day telling everyone I was going to play for South Australia when I was 19 and play for Australia when I was 21. The funny thing was everyone laughed at me. And I call it my light bulb moment, Julian, because I had this belief, innate belief in myself from a very young age that I was going to play for Australia. I could see it, I could taste it, I could feel it. But in that moment when I shared that with everyone at the career club and everyone started laughing at me, I realised then that I had to change because they couldn't see what I felt. Obviously, I wasn't doing what anyone thought would lead to me playing for Australia, so I had to change. And it was the moment that it did change me because, you know, I remember measuring out a big long run up and I started to run in a bob because I reflected back on it and I realized I was just going through the motions. I was just doing the bare minimum and stuff like that. I wasn't actually really backing it up with all the preparation, the training and whatever. So I started to train hard. I was running in hard, bowling as fast as I possibly could. You know, I was holding back before because I was so worried about getting injured and stuff like that. And I was playing fourth grade and just bowling medium pace. And then I just started to wind up and just bowl as fast as I could.
Did it feel different when you came in off the long run and really tried to go as fast as you can? It sounds like something changed in you, but also people noticed something different as well.
Well, that's exactly what happened. They noticed because I started hitting batsmen. I was this 16, 17-year-old D grader. And all of a sudden I have all these A graders jumping around, hopping around the crease. So then I just kept working on it and kept getting myself strong and fit and made my A-grade debut at the end of that season and things went from there, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty big thing for a young cricketer to say, I'm going to play for my state by the age of 19. I'm going to play for Australia by 21. But you did both those things. Yeah. Your test debut was in 1996, but you've chosen before that as the year that made you, Jason. What year have you chosen and why?
1995 was probably the year, and probably for a couple of reasons. I was 19, turning 20, early 1995, made my Shepherdshire debut. Also, my eldest daughter, Safi, was born in March, and I went to the AIS, the Career Academy. So I played a few Shepherdshire, you know, that season, played three Shepherdshire games. My daughter was born, and then I went to the Career Academy and had the winter training to build up and got fitter, I got stronger. You know, while I'd put on pace, I was still probably in first class cricket, I was still seeing probably a medium pacer, but I came back, I worked hard that whole winter at the academy, juggling that with being a new young dad, and started the next summer playing for South Australia, and I was bowling about a yard or two faster and I was more accurate. And then I had a big summer, 95, 96, which culminated in me getting opportunity to play for Australia, call up for the World Cup. So 1995 was a really big year for me.
Yeah, that's a lot going on for a young fella.
A lot going on. And that was a year that really put me on the map in terms of Australian cricket. You know, I'd sort of improved my pace a lot, my accuracy. And, you know, I think I got the selectors to sit up and take notice.
When did you find out that you were selected for South Australia the first time?
Well, I remember finding out how I was picked for South Australia. I think I finished a shift at the pizza bar that I was doing pizza deliveries at. And it was after midnight. I was at a service station up at O'Halloran Hill in the southern suburbs on the way home. And I was just putting some fuel in my car. I went in to pay and the news was on the radio. And they said they named the South Australian team. They said, oh, young Jason Gillespie from the Adelaide Cricket Club's been picked to play for South Australia. Yeah, that's how I found out I played for South Australia. I heard it on the radio in a survey.
And you mentioned that 1995 was the year that your daughter Sapphire was born. How did being a young dad change your experience as an emerging cricketer? I mean, it's a lot to handle.
Yeah, so, I mean, the academy at the time was based in Adelaide. Obviously, with Sappy being born, I'm staying at home to help raise her. So I was a scholarship holder there, but I was living at home and I just attend all the training sessions. And Rod Marsh was the coach. Rod was very understanding, knowing that I had a newborn daughter at home, and he basically just let me train and the family time outside of that. So Rod was very understanding of the situation that I was in. It had its challenges, you know. Obviously, you know, I wasn't earning a hell of a lot of money or anything like that. I was getting a lot of support from mum and dad. They were helping with the house that, you know, I was living in. Mum and dad were living interstate. I was living with my then partner at the time, and it was tough at times. There's no doubt about that. And my partner and I, there were probably times we weren't particularly getting along. So it was a bit of a challenging time. We were very young. And all of a sudden, we've got a young child. But that was a tough time to navigate through. Cricket probably saved me as much as anything and had that real focus with cricket. But yeah, Safi was a shining light in that time. And, you know, she's grown up to be a beautiful, wonderful lady. And she's got a family of her own now. And, you know, it's a pretty special time.
On the year that made me, we're speaking with Jason Gillespie, and 1995 is the year that Jason chose. That led to 1996, which is when you made your test debut. Looking back at the whole time you played for Australia, what would you say were the highest highs and the lowest lows?
Oh, the highest highs, I mean, there's so many of them. I always look at the team success, and it's a team game. That's what you play for. And to do that with your mates along the way is pretty bloody special, to be honest. So that they're the highs. I mean, the lows, obviously, is when, you know, certainly when I was getting hurt and, you know, I wasn't able to play, I was injured. So I had many of those. You know, I ran into Steve Waugh in a test match in Sri Lanka, broke my leg, you know, sitting in the hospital bed and being out for basically the whole season there. That really got me thinking I need to change the way I prepare and train. And you know, I was always a hard trainer, but I then got really specific after that and left no stone unturned and came back and had a 5 or so year period where I was relatively injury-free, which was great. But before that, I'd been in the late 90s through injuries and whatnot, bruised heels, knee injuries, back injuries, you name it, I had it. And they were all very frustrating. Then the broken leg came, and that made me reassess my whole preparation and training. And then after that, I had some sustained periods in the side. We had some success as a team, which was great. Losing the Ashes in 05 hurt, and it hurt me specifically because I didn't contribute to the team. I was poor in that tour. I got dropped because I wasn't bowling well enough, and rightly so. Yeah, it grated me because I felt I let the team down, and, you know, that hurt a lot. But it is what it is. It was another funny kind of way. It was great to be part of a wonderful test series, even though we were on the wrong side of the results. But I mean, it's a long time ago now, and you tend to look back on things a bit more fondly and remember the good stuff than the bad stuff. But overall, Julian, I can't complain too much about my career. I've been very fortunate. Not a lot of people get to represent Australia in sport, and I've been very blessed in that regard.
How do you go about measuring the double century with some of your best bowling performances? Is it even possible to put them on the same scale?
Oh, man, I'll be honest. It's very easy for me. My role in the team was to bowl cricket balls. If I could contribute with the bat and help support her at the other end, and then I was doing my job. But, you know, for me, my whole thing was about contributing with the ball, and that was my job. And I prided myself on my job. But what it has given me is a great sportsman's night story for over the last 20 years. I add a little bit of mayonnaise to that story as well, just for a laugh. But it's all good fun. Nothing but fond memories of that. I suppose it's nice to be remembered for something, isn't it? Yeah, you know, a lot of people mention the 200. I do have to remind people, well, I actually did take over 200 test wickets.
One of the things that attention wasn't drawn to when you made your test debut, but which later became a very prominent thing, was that when you made your test debut, you became the first Indigenous male test player. How did that come to prominence, Jason? And I wonder if you could talk about your sense of identity before and after that moment.
Well, the sense of identity never changed, because from as young as I can remember, we knew that we were Indigenous. You know, Mum and Dad would talk about it from a very young age. So we knew from a very young age, Julian, that we were Indigenous. And I just assumed, I suppose, naively or not, that there were other Australian cricketers that had Indigenous heritage. So it was a shock to me when Robert Craddock, you know, a good friend of mine, Crash, he wrote an article saying that I was the first acknowledged male Indigenous cricketer. And that really blew me away. You know, look, Dad, up until about 18 months before he passed away, Dad was the CEO of Aboriginal Legal Rights in South Australia. My brother Rob, to this day, is a field officer for ALRM. So it's something that we've always known and been incredibly proud of, very proud of our heritage. And so in answer to your question, nothing really changed, because it's always part of who we are.
On your mother's side, you also had Greek heritage. Made me wonder, Jason, were you also the first Greek Australian to play test cricket for Australia?
I'm not sure. Yeah, on my mother's side, my grandfather and grandmother came out from Kithara, an island off the coast of Greece. So I think it's a little fishing island. So yeah, so got a mix of Indigenous and Greek heritage. So yeah, very proud of that. We were a very multicultural country, Australia, and it's something that I believe we should be very, very proud of, you know, and I'm certainly part of that heritage, and, you know, it's something that we should all be very proud of.
In your 2007 book, Dizzy the Jason Gillespie Story, you said you couldn't see yourself being a full-time coach. What changed, Jason?
That's a great question. And at the time, I didn't. It was not something that was particularly on my radar. I always felt that the media was going to be something that I wanted to do. I remember doing media studies in high school, and I remember putting together radio shows and that and things like that. That's something I loved. And I thought, wow, maybe that's something I'll do. And funny enough, I'm now doing a bit of media and doing some radio commentary and things like that. That 51 years of age now. But yeah, the coaching came around. It was right at the end of my career. I was playing county cricket at Glamorgan in the English County Championship. And I was the overseas pro bowling there. And there were a couple of young bowlers that sort of I took under my wing sort of thing. It was just helping them at training and in and around games. And our director of cricket, Matt Maynard, actually just said, oh, have you thought about going into coaching? Because I've noticed you've been spending the time with the bowlers and they seem to like spending time talking cricket with you and that. And is that something you'd be interested in? And I said, look, I'll be honest, I hadn't really thought of it. And he said, look, even if it doesn't go anywhere, go and get your coaching levels. So go and do those courses. And you never know, it might just come in handy for you at some point down the track. So I ended up doing it and then got a job coaching a South Australian country team. Didn't mind it, it was a bit of fun. And then I got an email out of the blue from the late Heath Streak, who I'd played cricket against when he played for Zimbabwe, and played with him in the Indian Cricket League with the Ahmedabad Rockets. And he emailed me out of the blue and said, oh, there may be an opportunity for you here in Zimbabwe. There's a team in our domestic competition called the Midwest Rhinos need a coach. And there's a lot of restructure going on in Zimbabwe cricket. And I recommended you. I think you'd be a great fit for that team. And then it just literally went from there and got offered this job. And then my wife asked me,
yeah, where's this Zimbabwe team based? Yeah,
that's right. And would we be safe? Because we had three young kids under the age of five at the time. And I said, look, I've been to Zimbabwe before, played there. It's a great country, loved it. People are amazing. You'll be safe, no problem. So we made the move and I went to the middle of Zimbabwe and coaching the Midwest Rhinos. And yeah, so I remember being in Zimbabwe after a day's play, and I think I was just sitting having a drink outside, and Anna's kind of looked over at me and she just said, you're really loving what you're doing here, aren't you? And I kind of turned to her and said, yeah, I really do. I really enjoy this coaching and I'm loving being here. And I suppose it just went from there. And I did that for a couple of seasons and loved every minute of it. Learned a lot in Zimbabwe about coaching, but about man management, I think. Different personalities, different environments, and things just went from there.
What have you learned from becoming a coach?
Yeah, a few things. I touched on the man management. And the reason why I said that is coming from Australia, professional cricket, playing county cricket, playing international cricket. So then going to a country and domestic cricket where sometimes cricket wasn't the be-all and end-all. Like, these guys are real lives and real challenges in a, you know, in a third world country. I mean, we had players earning very little for full-time cricket contracts. You know, so much so that players wouldn't bring food to training or games because they couldn't afford to buy a sandwich. That was very different. And managing players there, you just had to think on my feet a little bit more and probably put my ego away and just look to learn to understand the individuals, the players, their situations. I suppose developing those relationships was important and develop that trust. Then you can, I suppose, start helping with cricket. So that was one thing I learned. I probably learned as a coach to talk less and listen more. That's, I think, when I first went into coaching, probably spoke more than I listened. This is how we're doing things and just go bull at a gate. It was through good intention, of course, but as you sort of go along, you sort of learn to listen a lot more.
What are you listening for?
Well, you want players to problem solve. You want players to think for themselves. You want independent thinking players. And for me, that's really important because ultimately players go out on the ground. The coaches are sitting on the sideline watching and all sorts of things are happening out on the ground. You can't be running out messages and notes every 5 minutes, can you, to instruct and like other sports, you know, you look at sports like basketball, the coaches on the sideline are very active and can call timeouts and come in and they run plays and do all this. And cricket is a very different beast. Do you need players to be able to think on their feet, think for themselves, problem solve? So for me, I think that's really important to create an environment as a coach where players are free to think clearly, speak openly, create discussion and, you know, work things out and solve problems. Because if they can do that and have good clarity around that, then once they get on the ground, when they're confronted with the situation, they've got the tools to be able to solve whatever problem that they encounter out on the ground. So as a coach, I believe that you're there to facilitate that and support that.
You copped a bit of stick as a player for your hair. You talk about that in your memoir. And I noticed you copped a little bit of stick in the commentary box for the ABC as well for the fact that you're a vegan these days. When and why did you become a vegan, Jason?
Jimmy Maxwell's the one that gets stuck.
He seems to have a real problem with it.
He does. Look, back in 2014, I was living in England, coaching Yorkshire. I remember just my wife Anna and I was watching TV. We watched a documentary called Earthlings. And I've never been an out-and-out animal lover, so to speak, growing up. I was just too obsessed with sport. But for some reason, this this doco just hit me in a way that I can't really describe. It just really hit me. I don't know how else to describe it, Julian. And from that moment, I've just gone, wow. And I can't consume animals. Can't use animals like that. That's wrong. And from that moment, I went vegan overnight. A lot of people transition. They go, maybe try meat-free Mondays or vegetarian days or whatever, and then transition over a period of time. But I literally went, from the moment that doco finished, I went vegan, and I've been vegan since then.
Yeah, so it's clearly like a personal ethical choice that you've made.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, it is.
Has anyone in the cricket fraternity taken your lead?
Not to my knowledge. I know Peter Siddle has been vegan for a lot longer than me. I don't know anyone that's on the back of my chat to them have transitioned to vegetarian or vegan diet. But
how long do you think it'll take to convert Jim Maxwell?
No, that will never happen. I can assure you, Jimbo, that would never happen. But look, I'm not a preacher. I understand we live in a non-vegan world. And for me, I just try to do the best I can and what I feel is right. And I don't begrudge people for their beliefs. It's not my place to tell people what to do or anything like that. And I think we all learnt in this world that people don't like being told what to do as a general rule. And so, look, if anyone wants to have a conversation with me and talk about why I'm a vegan and what my beliefs are, then I'm happy to sit down and have a chat about it. But each to their own is what I say.
Has the family gone vegan as well?
My eldest son and my wife went vegetarian for a few years, but they've gone back to the dark side now. But my other kids are full-blown carnivores, so I don't impose it on them. It's up to them to make their choices, and I'll support them in whatever choices they make.
And it's really interesting, some of the tidbits that slip out during a long test match of commentary as well. Jason, one of the things I noticed this year was you mentioned the fact that you're not particularly comfortable with crowds, which I found pretty amazing for somebody who spent a decade in front of massive crowds. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, I suppose when there's a lot of people around and you're in an enclosed space, I just find it a little bit unnerving, a bit intimidating. It's not like I can't be there or anything like that. I just like my own space, and I just don't like crowded places. Like if you go to a pub or something with your mates or whatever, I don't like going to those busy ones where there's lots of people around, everyone's standing around and that. I just feel uncomfortable with it. And when you're at a cricket game or a footy game or whatever, and there's lots of people and in a very small space, yeah, I just feel a bit uncomfortable. So I just avoid that where I can. I mean, obviously when I'm at test matches commentating and that, they're great atmospheres and I love it, but I do enjoy sitting up in the comm box as opposed to being out in the crowd. That makes me just a bit more comfortable, that's all.
Speaking of sitting in the crowd, I also read that you were once fielding on the boundary and looked around to see your dad singing with the Barmy Army. Is that true?
That might have been true, yeah. He was a real character, my dad, Neil. And he sadly missed. He died a number of years ago now. You know, his nickname was Have a Chat. He would literally talk to anyone and befriend anyone. And it didn't bother him if they were English Barmy Army supporters or whatever. He would have told them that, oh, that's my boy out there playing. Dad absolutely loved chatting to him. And he had a bit of a sing-along with him and ribbed them a bit, get stuck into him a bit about being English. And they'd get stuck into him for being an Aussie, but all in good fun. I think cricket crowds, they give each other a lot of stick, but they're all there for the same reason because they all love the game. Yeah, so get stuck into each other, but there's that respect there because they're all there because of the game.
Just as long as you don't have to sit in it.
Correct, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Jason, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us for The Year That Made Me. And we always finish The Year That Made Me with a piece of music. What have you chosen for us and why?
Late 80s, early 90s, I quite enjoyed my hard rock and heavy metal. Things like, you know, Led Zeppelin, Van Halen, Metallica and the like. So, well, I thought around that time, I was listening to a bit of Metallica, but I thought the Metallica Black Album, I think, came out in 1991, and probably Enter Sandman is something that we all remember. It's a famous tune, so I'll probably go with that.
Fantastic. Well, Jason Gillespie, thanks once again.
Thank you.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.